Welcome back, our fellow patriots, to the Patriot Lessons American History and Civics podcast. Today, we continue our deep dive into the Declaration of Independence. We have completed our review of its 27 grievances and are now diving into the next major section of this fundamental document, addressing how the petitions of the colonies to the empire and to the British people have been rejected. If you missed our prior episodes, you might want to go back and catch up to where we are now. Today, I'm joined by Mike Gerard and bombastic Brent Bassett. We are exploring the following next two paragraphs from the Declaration of Independence. Quote, "In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people. Nor have we been wanting in attentions to our British brethren. We have warned them from time to time of attempts by their legislature to extend an unwarrantable jurisdiction over us. We have reminded them of the circumstances of our immigration and settlement here. We have appealed to their native justice and magnanimity, and we have conjured them by the ties of our common kindred to disavow these usurpations, which would inevitably interrupt our connections and correspondence. They too have been deaf to the voice of justice and consanguinity. We must therefore acquiesce in the necessity which denounces our separation and hold them, as we hold the rest of mankind, enemies in war, in peace, friends." Unquote. To get us started is Mike Gerard, host of his own Be Reasonable podcast and fabulous sound designer of this podcast. Mike Gerard, take it away.
Why, thank you, Judge. Now, with regards to the Declaration of Independence, we've explored the introduction, the declaration of our founding first principles, and the 27 grievances against the empire. These grievances detailed, in painstaking detail, the various oppressions and usurpations that the empire had dealt the colonists. The next paragraph is as follows. "In every stage of these oppressions, we have petitioned for redress in the most humble terms. Our repeated petitions have been answered only by repeated injury. A prince whose character is thus marked by every act which may define a tyrant is unfit to be the ruler of a free people." In English history, the idea of petition involved a legal challenge. That is, a person or organization could petition a court or some other government actor to provide a legal remedy. Today, we generally don't think of filing a lawsuit as a petition for relief, but you just need to think about it for a second, and it makes sense. A person files a complaint or some other legal document with a court and asks the court to enter an order to obtain some kind of legal relief. A common example is a request for a judgment for money damages against a private citizen, say for a breach of contract. Another example is a request for the entry of an injunction, that is, an order forcing someone to do something or not do something. Think of someone ordered not to disclose someone else's confidential trade secrets, like Coca-Cola's secret formula. Another kind of lawsuit is when a person sues the government and wants the government to do something or to stop doing something. A really important example is a writ of mandamus. Now, writ in Latin means order, and mandamus means we command. So a writ of mandamus is issued by the court in response to a petition filed by a plaintiff. This particular kind of order requires the government to fulfill a clear duty it has and is failing to do. A simple and clear example is this. Imagine you've done everything you need to get your driver's license, but your Department of Motor Vehicles simply refuses to give it to you. Or let's say you've registered to vote, have your voter registration card, and show up at the correct polling station, and they just say no thanks, you're too dumb to vote. Now, a writ of mandamus is the legal mechanism to get your driver's license or to exercise your right to vote. In England, the first solid codification of this idea was in Chapter 61 of the Magna Carta, which, by the way, means Great Charter. Remember the original Magna Carta of 1215. Now, there's a few other documents that pop up later with the same name, but that one was a written agreement by Bad King John and the nobles by which the king recognized certain rights and privileges, mostly in favor of the nobles. Although extremely limited, it was really the first time in Western civilization that a king, in a written document, guaranteed rights to some of his subjects and, important for our purposes, established a legal mechanism by which to enforce it. The Magna Carta has 63 chapters, establishing various rights of the king's subjects. The 61st chapter created a way to enforce the document. In essence, it established a council of 25 nobles who could be petitioned by the people seeking to enforce the guarantees provided in the Magna Carta. Now, this really helped solidify the idea of the first principle of the rule of law, by which the government, as well as the governed, needed to follow the law. Now, let's fast forward several centuries. In 1628, Parliament confronted King Charles I with the Petition of Right. It claimed that the king had violated the law and had several key demands for reigning in the king. First, no taxation without the consent of Parliament. Second, no imprisonment without due process of law through lawful judgment of his or her peers. Third, no quartering of troops. Fourth, no martial law in peacetime. The king accepted the petition, and it was soon considered to be binding constitutional law. Historian Pauline Maier summarized this idea.
Petitions were addresses that asked for something, and one specific type, petitions of right, had a particular important place in English practice. They gave subjects a way of seeking redress of wrongs done under the authority of the king, whom they could not sue in the regular courts. Petitions of right asked for the recognition of undoubted rights, not mercy, and were directed to the king as the font of justice.
In the wake of the Glorious Revolution of 1688, Parliament passed and newly installed monarchs William and Mary accepted the Bill of Rights of 1689. That Bill of Rights specifically recognized the rights of British subjects to petition the king, and that no subject could be punished for doing so. The legal right to petition had been broadened beyond the original petition in a court of law to one directed to the government at large and asking for executive and legislative relief. Often such petitions have legal justification or arguments, but it's not always the case. When the Founding Fathers referred to petitions in the Declaration of Independence, they weren't thinking about the narrow view of a petition in a court of law. Instead, more in accord with the Bill of Rights of 1689, they were thinking about formal written demands made by the people and presented to the Parliament, King, and even the people. This is very much like the right to petition protected in the First Amendment. Today, when we hear petition, we typically think of a piece of paper with some kind of call for action at the top and a bunch of signatures below it. Although the format could be similar, the founding generation mostly issued their petitions in much more formal and grandiose terms. They were usually not drafted by individual subjects, but by business associations, towns, state legislatures, and eventually the Continental Congress. They typically were not signed by a long list of people, but were issued under the authority of the sponsoring organization or governmental unit, sometimes signed by its president or clerk. These were not slapped together at a moment's notice, but were the result of careful drafting, contentious debate, compromise, and solemn approval. The period leading up to the American Revolution was marked with many vital and forceful petitions. The passage of the Stamp Act in 1765 really sparked this movement with deadly seriousness. When news of the Stamp Act hit the American shores, the reaction was initially hesitant and uncertain. That is, until Patrick Henry walked into history. A few episodes ago, the one dealing with taxation without representation, we discussed at length how Patrick Henry had rallied the Virginia House of Burgesses to pass strongly worded condemnations of the Stamp Act. Those Virginia resolves, however, did not specifically petition anyone. When news hit Massachusetts that Parliament had enacted the Stamp Act, James Otis took action. Otis was a brilliant and influential lawyer and political leader in the Massachusetts legislature. On June 8, 1765, he moved that a circular letter be sent to all the colonial governments to send delegates to a Congress to discuss how to combat this affront to English liberty. 9 colonies jumped on board and delegates met in New York in October 1765. The Stamp Act Congress approved a Declaration of Rights and Grievances to be sent back to London. However, only 6 of the colonies signed on because the delegates of 3 colonies had not been authorized to approve anything. Instead, they had just been authorized to discuss and confer about the Stamp Act. It was of no matter because the Stamp Act Congress's declaration and petition was very powerful and set the tenor of American resistance for the next 11 years. We addressed much of the substance of the Declaration of Rights and Petitions in earlier episodes, so we won't spend too much time going over its substance, but it is important to hear what the colonists thought about the importance of petitioning about their grievances. Most historians think that it was written by John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, but others conclude that John Kruger, the mayor of New York, authored it. The style is very respectful, but also very demanding. Whoever wrote it, he or they put out a powerful signal about the magnitude the colonists viewed petitioning the crown. Take a listen to what they issued on October 19, 1765.
The members of this Congress, sincerely devoted, with the warmest sentiments of affection and duty, to His Majesty's person and government, inviolably attached to the present happy establishment of the Protestant succession, and with minds deeply impressed by a sense of the present and impending misfortunes of the British colonies on this continent, having considered as maturely as time would permit the circumstances of said colonies, esteem it our indispensable duty to make the following declarations of our humble opinions respecting the most essential rights and liberties of the colonists, and of the grievances under which they labor, by reason of several late acts of Parliament.
So that was the setup to the grievances. The Stamp Act Congress then listed 13 various arguments which, in one way or another, were assaults on the Stamp Act or a defense of the colony's resistance to the same, the last of which was
that it is the right of the British subjects in these colonies to petition the King or either House of Parliament.
The Stamp Act then concluded with how the declaration and petition was not just fulfilling a right, but the colonists had an affirmative duty to issue it.
It is the indispensable duty of these colonies to the best of sovereigns, to the mother country, and to themselves, to endeavor by a loyal and dutiful address to His Majesty and humble application to both houses of Parliament to procure the repeal of the Act for granting and applying certain stamp duties.
And as we learned, this petition was not for naught. It was the first continent-wide uniting of resistance to British tyranny. Although we don't want to exaggerate the importance of this particular set of resolutions, it was widely distributed across the empire. Resistance to the Stamp Act became universal across the colonies. Boycotts of British goods were quickly enacted. Stamp collectors were coerced to resign. Stamps were confiscated. The Stamp Act was dead on arrival. The Empire backed down and repealed it. But as we learned, Parliament couldn't help itself. Soon it passed the Townshend Acts, which we've also addressed in great detail in prior episodes. For our purposes here, it kicked off another round of petitions in various forms. For example, the Massachusetts House addressed a series of letters to various officials in London. Letters were sent to the Massachusetts agent, Dennis de Brett, Lord Camden, Earl of Shelburne, and the Marquis of Rockingham. Now, the last two were leading officials of the Empire's treasury. The letters were drafted by future Son of Liberty, Samuel Adams, and he argued that the Constitution was fixed and that the Townshend Acts violated its fixed principles. Massachusetts, again with Samuel Adams' leadership, also directly petitioned the King on January 20, 1768. Like the Stamp Act Declaration of Rights and Grievances, this petition was very respectful, almost apologetic in tone.
Your Majesty's faithful subjects, the representatives of your province, the Massachusetts Bay, with the warmest intentions of loyalty, duty, and affection, beg leave to approach the throne and to lay at your Majesty's feet their humble supplications in behalf of your subjects, the people of this province.
The petition then went on to explain that the colonists had established the colony and been granted the rights and privileges of Englishmen.
The principle of which is that your Majesty's subjects in the realm have ever held as a most important right of their being taxed only by representatives of their own free selection.
The petition further explained that the Townshend Acts clearly violated this sacred right. As you might have guessed, this petition never received a direct response. But, as we learned in prior episodes, the Townsend Acts were also eventually repealed because of widespread resistance to their enforcement. After the Boston Tea Party, the English Empire passed a set of laws which the colonists dubbed the Intolerable Acts, also known as the Coercive Acts. These acts tried to coerce the colonies into submission to the iron rule of the empire. And they didn't work. Instead, they tended to drive up even more resistance to England's oppression, and the colonists reacted by convening the First Continental Congress. Thomas Jefferson was unable to attend the Congress, but he used the opportunity to draft a groundbreaking set of instructions for the Virginia delegation to consider. They were later printed with this very long title, A Summary View of the Rights of British America, set forth in some resolutions intended for the inspection of the present delegates of the people of Virginia, now in convention by a native and member of the House of Burgesses.
And you think I'm wordy?
Seriously, you'd think that Jefferson was a paperback writer. Oh, no.
Paperback writer!
That didn't take any work at all.
That was really amazing. He laid his own trap.
Oh, seriously, what a ridiculous song. Paperback writer, paperback writer. It's like, oh, I just want to work in a drugstore. Drugstore worker, drugstore worker. Say it about 50 times and maybe I can have the success that they did. Repetitive drivel. All right, anyways, we'll just call Jefferson's paperback, pamphlet, A Summary View on the Rights of British America. And we've referred to it quite a bit in this series because it gave a great preview of many portions of the Declaration of Independence. In connection with the petitions to the English government, what's interesting is that the whole document is phrased as a resolution which directs the First Continental Congress to issue a petition to the king. Take a listen to the introduction. Resolved that it be an instruction to the said deputies, when assembled in General Congress with the deputies from the other states of British America, to propose to the said Congress that a humble and dutiful address be presented to His Majesty, begging leave to lay before him, as Chief Magistrate of the British Empire, the united complaints of His Majesty's subjects in America. Complaints which are excited by many unwarrantable encroachments and usurpations attempted to be made by the legislature of one part of the empire, upon whose rights which God and the laws have given equally and independently to all. Then, the summary view actually reviews the fact that some of the individual colonies had previously petitioned the king for relief but never received it, and that it was time for the colonies to unite to petition yet again. To represent to His Majesty that these states have often individually made humble application to His Imperial Throne to obtain, through its intervention, some redress of their injured rights, to none of which was ever even an answer condescended. Humbly to hope that this their joint address, penned in the language of truth, and divested of those expressions of servility which would persuade His Majesty that we are asking favors and not rights, shall obtain from His Majesty a more respectful acceptance. And that His Majesty will think we have reason to expect when he reflects that he is no more than the chief officer of the people, appointed by the laws and circumscribed with definite powers to assist in working the great machine of government erected for their use and consequently subject to their superintendence. Notice there some of the echoes of the beginning of the Declaration of Independence. It refers to the language of truth, that the people have rights, and that the king is no more than a servant to the people. This kernel, the core of the Declaration of Independence, is there. In the Declaration itself, it will transfigure into self-evident truths, unalienable rights, and that the purpose for government is to protect those rights, key touchstones of our founding first principles. Jefferson's draft was not adopted, but something akin to it was. We've also discussed that the First Continental Congress promulgated the Declaration and Resolves of the First Continental Congress, which was adopted on October 14, 1774. It rallied against the Intolerable Acts and included the following resolution of action for the colonists.
First, to enter into a non-importation agreement or association, 2, to prepare an address to the people of Great Britain and a memorial to the inhabitants of British America, and 3, to prepare a royal address to His Majesty, agreeable to the resolutions already entered into.
Exactly 2 weeks later, on October 26, 1774, the First Continental Congress adopted its petition to the King in opposition to the Intolerable Acts. The over 2,100-word petition covered a wide range of grievances that we've addressed in this series, including the danger of a standing army, the replacement of civil authorities with military commanders, the creation of various governmental officers who were overburdening the colonies, and the Declaration of Independence called them locusts. There was the operation and establishment of new admiralty and vice-admiralty courts that were running roughshod over the unalienable rights of the colonists. The unwarranted dissolution of colonial assemblies, restrictions on trade, making judges dependent on their salaries to the imperial authorities, the Murder Act, the Boston Port Act, and the Quebec Act. But listen to how they introduced this list of grievances to the king.
To the King's Most Excellent Majesty, Most Gracious Sovereign, we, your Majesty's faithful subjects of the colonies of New Hampshire, Massachusetts Bay, Rhode Island, and Providence Plantations, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, the counties of Newcastle, Kent, and Sussex on Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, North Carolina, and South Carolina, in behalf of ourselves and the inhabitants of these colonies who have deputated us to represent them in General Congress, by this humble petition, beg leave to lay our grievances before the throne.
Did you catch that? The leading lights of the colonies are presenting a humble petition and beg leave to lay the grievances before the throne. Believing, well, more like hoping, that they had a good king who would act if he had their grievances just brought to his attention, the petition continued.
To a sovereign who glories in the name of Britain, the bare recital of these acts must, we presume, justify the loyal subjects who fly to the foot of his throne and implore his clemency for protection against them.
And then the petition makes a brilliant argument. It recognizes that British subjects are free men, and that divine providence has placed King George III on the throne to preserve that liberty, and that as a wise ruler appointed by the divine, he must recognize the rights of free men are being violated and must be compelled to act.
Had our Creator been pleased to give us existence in a land of slavery, the sense of our condition might have been mitigated by ignorance and habit. But thanks be to His adorable goodness, we were born the heirs of freedom, and ever enjoyed our right under the auspices of your royal ancestors, whose family was seated on the British throne, to rescue and secure a pious and gallant nation from the popery and despotism of a superstitious and inexorable tyrant. Your Majesty, we are confident, justly rejoices that your title to the crown is thus founded on the title of your people to liberty, and therefore we doubt not, but your royal wisdom must approve the sensibility that teaches your subjects anxiously to guard the blessing they received from divine providence, and thereby to prove the performance of that compact which elevated the illustrious House of Brunswick to the imperial dignity it now possesses.
But the Continental Congress was not done yet. It explained to the king that because he was obviously a lover of liberty, that his subjects had a duty to inform him of the injustices that were inflicted by his cruel ministry. Naturally, instead of being upset with the colonists, he would turn his wrath on these freedom-destroying ministers.
The apprehension of being degraded into a state of servitude from the preeminent rank of English freemen, while our minds retain the strongest love of liberty, and clearly foresee the miseries preparing for us and our posterity, excites emotions in our breast which, though we cannot describe, we should not wish to conceal. feeling as men, and thinking as subjects in the manner we do, silence would be disloyalty. By giving this faithful information, we do all in our power to promote the great objects of your royal cares, the tranquility of your government, and the welfare of your people. Duty to your majesty and regard for the preservation of ourselves and our posterity, the primary obligations of nature and of society, command us to entreat your attention. And as your majesty enjoys the signal distinction of reigning over freemen, we apprehend the language of freemen cannot be displeasing. Your royal indignation, we hope, will rather fall on those designing and dangerous men who daringly interposing themselves between your royal person and your faithful subjects, and for several years past incessantly employed to dissolve the bonds of society, by abusing your majesty's authority, misrepresenting your American subjects, and prosecuting the most desperate and irritating projects of oppression, have at length compelled us, by the force of accumulated injuries, too severe to be any longer tolerable, to disturb your majesty's repose by our complaints.
After further elaborating at great length, the colonists made a closing prayer for relief. The king, who had no idea what was going on, read the petition, and then immediately fired his leading ministers and started to move towards reconciliation with his unintentionally oppressed American subjects.
What are you laughing at?
But seriously, the myth of a conspiratorial set of bad ministers working behind the back of a well-intentioned but kept-in-the-dark king may have been wishful thinking by the Continental Congress, or maybe they just felt they had to go through the motions to continue to gain support at home. Or maybe they thought it would give some cover to a king who was now regretting what was happening in America. But whatever the Congress was thinking, the myth of a conspiratorial set of bad ministers was just that, a myth. Historian Pauline Maier explained the king's true reaction.
George III never wavered in supporting the rights of Parliament. The king was stubborn, not especially imaginative, and temperamentally disinclined to think through the careful arguments the colonists posed, which he quickly dismissed as the work of a few troublemakers. It was safer, he thought, to take a hard line than to make concessions to such nonsense. He also turned a deaf ear to petitions from the colonists' sympathizers in England, particularly the City of London, urging that he intervene on behalf of his American subjects. The First Continental Congress's petition to the king met no better fate.
The king simply ignored the petition. As we addressed in a prior episode, by the time it arrived in Britain, he had already made up his mind that the problem of America would be solved only by war. Still, the colonists were nothing but tenacious. Even after the shot heard round the world was fired at Lexington and Concord, that being on April 19, 1776, the Second Continental Congress felt compelled to send yet again another petition to the king. Known to history as the Olive Branch Petition, it was adopted on July 8, 1776. It also began with a greeting to the king and entreated the king's attention to their humble petition. The Olive Branch Petition also included a set of grievances, again blamed the king's ministers for oppression and justified the colonists' resistance, including with force of arms. They argued that resistance was a duty to themselves and their posterity. The petition additionally expressed humility, asked for the king to read the petition in the light of his royal magnanimity and benevolence, and expressed a desire to maintain allegiance to the king, his family, and the empire, and emphasized the long-standing and deep ties to Great Britain. The petition then made its pitch for relief from the throne.
We therefore beseech your majesty that your royal authority and influence may be graciously interposed to procure us relief from our afflicting fears and jealousies occasioned by the system before mentioned, and to settle peace through every part of our dominions. with all humility submitting to your majesty's wise consideration, whether it may not be expedient for facilitating those important purposes that your majesty be pleased to direct some mode by which the united applications of your faithful colonists to the throne, in pursuance of their common counsels, may be improved into a happy and permanent reconciliation, and that, in the meantime, measures may be taken for preventing the further destruction of the lives of your majesty's subjects, and that such statutes, as are more immediately distress any of your majesty's colonies, may be repealed.
Yes, it was pretty eloquent, and as we learned in a prior episode, completely dismissed. The refusal to even acknowledge these petitions outraged many colonists. In his amazingly influential Common Sense, Thomas Paine began with a different tactic altogether. Instead of raging against the lack of a response, he simply stated, as a matter of fact, that petitions were useless because of the complexity of governance in the colonies and the lengthy delays between a petition, a response, a counterpetition, etc. Of course, all going across the ocean blue. As to matters of government, it is not in the power of Britain to do this continent justice. The business of it will soon be too weighty and intricate to be managed with any tolerable degree of convenience by a power so distant from us and so very ignorant of us. For if they cannot conquer us, they cannot govern us. To be always running 3 or 4,000 miles with a tale or a petition, waiting 4 or 5 months for an answer which, when obtained, requires 5 or 6 more to explain it in, will in a few years be looked upon as folly and childishness. There was a time when it was proper, and there is a proper time for it to cease. But, as you might expect, Paine then went for the throat, literally, explaining that Americans should no longer debase themselves with petitions of peace and reconciliation, but instead should fight for their liberty. Every quiet method for peace hath been ineffectual. Our prayers have been rejected with disdain, and only tended to convince us that nothing flatters vanity or confirms obstinacy in kings more than repeated petitioning, and nothing hath contributed more than that very measure to make the kings of Europe absolute. Witness Denmark and Sweden. Wherefore, since nothing but blows will do, for God's sakes, let us come to a final separation, and not leave the next generation to be cutting throats under the violated, unmeaning names of parent and child. The founders realized that it was in vain to seek any redress from petitions. The time had come for blows to win the inalienable rights of Americans. South Carolina Chief Justice William Henry Drayton declared that war was inevitable.
British oppressions deeply affected all the colonies. Ruin stared them in the face. They united their councils and laid their just complaints before the throne, praying a redress of grievances. But to their astonishment, the dutiful petition for peace and safety was answered only by an actual commencement of war and military destruction. Thus forced to take up arms in our own defense, America yet again most dutifully petitioned the king. But it was in vain. The petition on the part of the millions, praying that the effusion of blood might be stayed, was not thought worthy of an answer. The nefarious war continued.
Repeatedly petitioning the king had led nowhere but to repeated injuries and war. The colonists concluded that the king was a tyrant and unfit to rule the free people of America. Judge, please take it from here.
Thanks, Mike Girard. There is an old political technique mastered by the great communicator, President Ronald Reagan, by which politicians go over the heads of the legislature and talk directly to the people. The idea is that if one is facing a reluctant Congress or state legislature or parliament, if you can convince the people that you're right, they in turn will exert influence on the legislators. Well, the colonists tried the same with the British. They addressed some of their petitions not to the king or parliament, but to the people of England. Although the king was not particularly influenced by public sentiment, the parliament was an elected body, and they could at times bend to public opinion. In fact, British merchants had great influence in convincing the parliament to repeal the Stamp Act. When the Stamp Act was passed, not only was it met with fierce resistance within the colonies, but the colonists went a step further and refused to buy British goods. The shockwave of losing the lucrative and growing colonial market sparked British merchants, especially those in London, to petition the Parliament to reverse course. As we discussed earlier, in the wake of the Intolerable Acts, the First Continental Congress passed three resolutions, one of which was to appeal to the people of Great Britain to eliminate the acts. On October 21, 1774, the petition was approved. It was addressed to the people of Great Britain and referred to them as friends and fellow subjects. This tract paralleled many of the arguments made by the Second Continental Congress in its petition to the king, but it was even longer, over 3,500 words. The petition reflected on how the colonists and English were brethren, descended from common ancestors, and were united in blood and rights. Echoing the sentiments to the king, it expressed the idea that the colonists had a duty to inform their fellow subjects on their oppression. This unhappy country has not only been oppressed, but abused and misrepresented, and the duty we owe to ourselves and posterity, to your interest and the general welfare of the British Empire, leads us to address you on this very important subject. The petition explained that the colonists had the rights of Englishmen, just like the people they were addressing, and the fact that an ocean separated them could not be a pretense to deprive the colonists of their unalienable rights. It then reviewed many of the grievances also outlined in the petition to the king. And then the petition took a different tack that was not available with the king. It warned their English brethren that they themselves would suffer negative consequences at home if a war was to break out, and that they too could even lose their liberty. Now mark the progression of the ministerial plan for enslaving us. This being a true state of facts, let us beseech you to consider to what end they lead. Admit that the ministry, by the powers of Britain and the aid of our Roman Catholic neighbors, should be able to carry the point of taxation and reduce us to a state of perfect humiliation and slavery. What advantages or what laurels will you reap from such a conquest? May not a ministry with the same armies enslave you? Do not treat this as chimerical. In a word, take care that you do not fall into the pit that is preparing for us. We believe there is yet much virtue, much justice, and much public spirit in the English nation. To that justice we now appeal. Permit us to be free as yourselves, and we shall ever esteem a union with you to be our greatest glory and our greatest happiness. We shall ever be ready to contribute all in our power to the welfare of the empire. We shall consider your enemies as our enemies, and your interest as our own. But if you are determined that your ministers shall wantonly sport with the rights of mankind, if neither the voice of justice, the dictates of the law, the principles of the Constitution, or the suggestions of humanity can restrain your hands from shedding human blood in such an impious cause, we must then tell you that we will never submit to be hewers of wood or drawers of water for any ministry or nation in the world. The petition then called upon the British public to elect a new parliament with members who would respect the rights of the colonists and bring back amity to the empire. No such luck. Historian Pauline Mayer explains what actually happened in the parliamentary elections.
The House of Commons, elected in the fall of 1774, proved no better than its predecessors. In opening the new parliament on November 30th, the king spoke of a most daring spirit of resistance and disobedience to law in Massachusetts, which was being supported by other colonies, and he reaffirmed his firm and steadfast resolution to withstand every attempt to weaken or impair the supreme authority of this legislature over all the dominions of my crown. Both Lords and Commons dutifully endorsed his position by comfortable majorities. Then, in February 1775, Parliament declared that Massachusetts was in a state of rebellion, supported by illegal combinations in other colonies, and it endorsed the king's intention to take the most effectual measures to enforce due obedience to the laws and authority of the Supreme Legislature. It went on to adopt the New England Restraining Act.
The best allies the colonists could conjure in Great Britain were the London merchants, who sent another petition to Parliament on January 23, 1775. It described the crushing effect of the renewed American import-export boycott of British goods. Unlike the petition addressing the Stamp Act, this petition fell on deaf ears. On April 26, 1775, the Massachusetts Provincial Congress issued a petition to the inhabitants of Great Britain. Under the leadership of its president and son of liberty, Dr. Joseph Warren, the Congress explained to the British people how Lexington and Concord began and firmly laid blame at the feet of British royal troops. Warren and the Congress believed it was extraordinarily important to go over the heads of the British ministry and to address the people of Great Britain directly. In that address, they made a direct appeal to the British public to change the course of affairs. These brethren are marks of ministerial vengeance against this colony for refusing with her sister colonies a submission to slavery. But they have not yet detached us from our royal sovereign. We profess to be his loyal and dutiful subjects, and so highly dealt with as we have been, are still ready with our lives and our fortunes to defend his person, family, crown, and dignity. Nevertheless, to the persecution and tyranny of his cruel ministry, we will not tamely submit. Appealing to heaven for the justice of our cause, we determine to die or be free. We cannot think that the honor, wisdom, and valor of Britons will suffer them to be longer inactive spectators of measures in which they themselves are so deeply interested, measures pursued in opposition to the solemn protest of many noble lords, an express sense of conspicuous commonness, whose knowledge and virtue have long characterized them as some of the greatest men in the nation. Measures executing contrary to the interest, petitions, and resolves of many large, respectable, and opulent counties, cities, and boroughs in Great Britain. Measures highly incompatible with justice, but still pursued with a specious pretense of easing the nation of its burden. Measures which, if successful, would end in the ruin and slavery of Britain, as well as the persecuted American colonies. We sincerely hope that the great sovereign of the universe, who has so often appeared for the English nation, will support you in every rational and manly exertion with these colonies for saving it from ruin, and that in a constitutional connection with the mother country, we shall soon be altogether a free and happy people. Okay, I'm totally biased, and yes, he is a distant relative, he's the brother of my direct descendant, but seriously, there is more eloquence and power in that statement than anything I've heard in the last 30 years from the public stage. I mean, this is a masterpiece.
Okay, Judge, calm down, we get it. You share his blood and you get all excited. This does kind of explain some things, doesn't it? I better take over for a few minutes until the judge takes a few deep breaths. Despite Dr. Warren's eloquence, the petition had no effect in England. The colonists then turned their sights on Canada. They too were part of the British Empire and close neighbors to the North. The Great White North, that is.
Welcome to the Great White North.
Being in Michigan, we do have an affinity for those guys. Although, did you know that Detroit is actually north of Canada?
Bombastic Brent Bassett, you were complaining about the judge and now look at you. Get back on track.
Oh yeah, sorry. Now, it is true that Canada was recently conquered by the British in the French and Indian War, and many of the residents were French or descendants of the French who wanted nothing to do with the so-called British brethren in the lower colonies. They had a different worldview and did not share many of the feelings about rights and the purpose of government as the English. In fact, the Quebec Act worked to accommodate the French perspective in governance and religion. Still,
The Second Continental Congress optimistically saw an opening and issued a letter to the inhabitants of Canada on May 29, 1775. They thought that the Quebec Act, as we discussed in prior episodes, had created a despotic form of government in Canada and that Canada might be willing to break from England. Addressing the Canadians as friends and countrymen, leading statesman and future Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Jay, drafted the letter. The letter explained that the Canadians and 13 colonies faced a common foe who was trying to crush the unalienable rights of everyone in North America. The letter pleaded for the Canadians to join the colonists in fighting against Great Britain.
As we were both entitled by the bounty of an indulgent creator to freedom, and being devoted by the cruel edicts of a despotic administration to common ruin, we perceive the fate of the Protestant and Catholic colonies to be strongly linked together, and therefore invited you to join with us in resolving to be free, and in rejecting with disdain the fetters of slavery, however artfully polished.
The Americans declared that, like them, the Canadians were already living under tyranny. They needed to act.
By the introduction of your present form of government, or rather, present form of tyranny, you and your wives and your children are made slaves. You have nothing that you can call your own, and all the fruits of your labor and industry may be taken from you, whenever an avaricious governor and a rapacious council may incline to demand them. You are liable by their edicts to be transported into foreign countries to fight battles in which you have no interest, and to spill your blood in conflicts from which neither honor nor emolument can be derived. Nay, the enjoyment of your very religion on the present system depends on a legislature in which you have no share and over which you have no control, and your priests are exposed to expulsion, banishment, and ruin whenever their wealth and possessions furnish sufficient temptation. They cannot be sure that a virtuous prince will always fill the throne, and should a wicked or careless king concur with a wicked ministry in extracting the treasure and strength of your country, it is impossible to conceive to what variety and to what extremes of wretchedness you may, under the present establishment, be reduced.
The petition described point blank the colonists' decision to live free or die.
We, for our parts, are determined to live free, or not at all, and are resolved that posterity shall never reproach us with having brought slaves into the world.
Like Dr. Warren, John Jay had an inspiring flair for language, too. Despite its enthusiasm, majesty, and logic, this petition also failed to sway the British Brethren in Canada. That none of the petitions were working was obviously frustrating to the colonists. Still, in a fashion parallel to the Olive Branch petition, the Second Continental Congress issued a final petition to the Friends, Countrymen, and Brethren in Great Britain. Released on July 8, 1775, this last-ditch effort noted the rejected petition from the year before, reiterated and elaborated on the grievances and other remarks, and commented on new, troubling events. It pulled in at approximately 4,000 words. We could quote it at length, but you have heard all the arguments already in the prior petitions, and so had the English. It landed with a remarkable... Yes, it landed with a thud, dead on arrival. The Congress gave up on petitions. Soon it was emphasizing the reality that the petitions had gone unheeded, which in turn justified radical changes on the ground. For example, on May 15, 1776, the Second Continental Congress adopted John Adams' preamble to the resolution, enabling the colonies to start creating new governments. The preamble noted that,
"No answer whatever To the humble petitions of the colonies for redress of grievances and reconciliation with Great Britain has been or is likely to be given, but the whole force of that kingdom, aided by foreign mercenaries, is to be exerted for the destruction of the good people of these colonies.
The gig was up. The English people were not going to assist their brethren overseas. For now, they were enemies. The empire was not going to bend. It was utterly confident it would prevail. It was like fighting the Borg.
We are the Borg. Lower your shields and surrender your ships. We will add your biological and technological distinctiveness to our own. Your culture will adapt to service us. Resistance is futile.
In light of British intransigence, historian Herbert Friedenwald concisely summarized the situation.
Assertion of rights and recital of grievances had been met by determination to enforce submission. Memorials and resolutions appealing to the king, to Parliament, even to the English people, had been put aside and disregarded, or else had been succeeded by measures more obnoxious than those against which protest had been registered. In the Declaration of Rights and the other documents of the First Congress, repeal of practically all the acts now cited as warrant for breaking off the connection with Great Britain had been pleaded for in general as well as in specific terms. Every method known to the colonists to bring about the reforms desired had been tried with no results. They had now either to retreat or to fight on to victory.
The Founding Fathers had a couple of advantages. First, they had no idea what the Borg Collective was, so they did not think resistance was futile. Second, they were stock full of Kirks, Picards, and Janeways. The Founding Fathers chose...
Victory Screech!
Yes, the Founding Fathers sounded just like SpongeBob SquarePants. Of course, the Borg never did conquer Earth, and the English would end up losing America. But they were both stubborn until the end.
I'm not sure how the pedestrian topic of petitions bled into the Beatles. Okay, we do that every episode. But SpongeBob, the Borg, and the Great White North? We are truly creative. Some key takeaways from this episode. The Declaration of Independence reveals the colonists did not just willy-nilly declare independence, but they had petitioned over and over again the king and the people of the empire to back off from oppression. It was only when the founders realized that the king was a tyrant and the people of England would simply stand by and watch that it was time to make the final break. Please join us for our next general episode about the penultimate line of the Declaration of Independence. We therefore, the representatives of the United States of America, in General Congress assembled, appealing to the Supreme Judge of the World for the rectitude of our intentions, do in the name and by the authority of the good people of these colonies, solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states, that they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved, and that as free and independent states, they have full power to levy war, conclude peace, contract alliances, establish commerce, and to do all other acts and things which independent states may of right do. This podcast is produced by Patriot Week. Please visit Patriot Week's website at patriotweek.org for many fabulous resources, including our new daily video series, Save Our Republic. I am Oakland County Circuit Court Judge Michael Warren and author of America's Survival Guide. Our other two terrific Patriot narrators are Mike Gerard Skonechny, who is our sound designer and the host of his own unique podcast, Be Reasonable with Mike Gerard, and bombastic Brent Bassett, fabulous dad and husband and the host with the most. Our fellow patriots, thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless you and God bless America.
Thank you, our fellow patriots, for listening. Please subscribe to our podcast and rate us. That is, if you're going to give us those 5 golden stars. We can be found on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and many other platforms. You can also find much more at patriotweek.org, which includes videos, lesson plans, TV episodes, and many other goodies. Patriot Week is celebrated every year from September 11th, the anniversary of the terrorist attacks, through September 17th, the anniversary of the signing of the Constitution. It has been recognized by the U.S. Senate and many states. Patriot Week was started by then 10-year-old Leah Warren when she pounded on the table and demanded a new celebration of America. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and on Instagram, or reach out directly at mwarren@patriotweek.org. Also consider Judge Warren's book, America's Survival Guide, How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles and History, by visiting americasurvivalguide.com, Amazon, or any other online retailer. Until next time, God bless you and God bless America.